Coming up today, we're discussing the latest Apple launches, Google's $1 billion fleet of internet-providing satellites, and the reappropriation of a Hunger Games hand gesture in Thailand. We'll also consider the role of mindfulness in our tech-filled lives and a living sculpture of Van Gogh's ear made from cells taken from a relative. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to bioart and glass holes. I'm your host, Olivia Solon. I'm the deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
And I'm Katie Collins.
Can I say glass hole?
I think you can.
I think did.
I think it's a fairly accepted term now. In the dictionary before you know it.
Yes, Google glass holes. Apologies for any fragile little ears that heard that. But we are currently gearing up for Wired Money, which is an event that takes place on the 1st of July. And it's all about innovation and disruption in finance. And we have some amazing speakers, from economists, bankers, neuroscientists, security experts, cryptocurrency advocates, and startups. And if that's piques your interest, you should really check out the website. Just go to our homepage, and there's lots of links to the event site where you can find the full agenda and obviously book tickets. But let's get cracking with the news.
Google is going to be taking a giant leap for tech kind by spending more than $1 billion, that's about £600 million, on a fleet of satellites in order to spread its internet influence beyond the Earth's atmosphere.
Well, it's not actually going to be sending this for aliens or extraterrestrials. No. Or the ISS. It's for people who don't have access to the internet, like people in Cornwall.
Exactly, yeah. So we talked a little bit, I think it was last week, about a project that's designed to beam internet to the moon. This is focusing on people closer to home, and hopefully Google wants to attempt to bring internet access to areas of the world where there currently isn't any. And people have attempted to do this before using satellites, but due to kind of financial and technical and regulatory problems, I think that none have actually managed to succeed. But I imagine if anybody can do this, Google is probably the company that can achieve it.
And it's good to actually see a company put its money where its mouth is. We've seen a lot of people talking about blimps using to beam internet over Africa. I think Facebook's talked about different initiatives, but actually this is a huge commitment, a huge financial commitment to actually getting things done.
Yeah, massively so. So initially there will be 180 satellites as part of the program, although this could potentially increase as well. And there'll be small, high capacity satellites which will create a sort of mesh network, and they'll orbit at a lower altitude than other satellites in order that they don't interfere. And that's one of the regulatory problems that Google's going to have to deal with in order to be able to get permission to send them up there in the first place. But Google's actually managed to do this by, through one of its many recent acquisitions and sort of hiring sprees that it's been on. It's brought on board a guy called Greg Weiler, who is the founder of a satellite communication startup, which was working on improving broadband access through satellites. And Google was actually an early investor in this business. And they've bought Weiler in, and I think the CTO of his business as well. And now they've got about 10 to 20 engineers all working together on this project.
Okay.
So
they're quite small, the satellites, aren't they?
The satellites that Google's going to be launching weigh a little bit over 110 kilos. And this kind of technology a few years ago would have been really, really expensive to make. Because the price has actually come down so much, that's what's allowed Google to say that they're going to send 180 satellites up. But there are people that reckon they might be being a little bit overly optimistic with how little it's going to cost. And there are predictions out there that say it's going to cost close to $3 billion, actually.
But still, we'll have to pocket see. Change for Google. Well, yeah. No, that's a hefty chunk of Google's revenue, but nothing too painful.
Yeah, exactly. And I find it quite interesting because it is somewhat reminiscent of Facebook's initiative, but it does make you wonder a little bit whether, because Google's attempting to do this alone, whereas Facebook's recognised that it's a social network fundamentally, and it's going to need partners, different technology companies, all sorts of people on board, people who are building networks, that kind of thing. And Google's kind of just going it alone, and it makes you wonder whether it's going to be able to kind of have the same success in bringing people online or not.
What I think is more kind of interesting is going to be how much it's going to cost to keep this running. I don't know if the setup, if the $1 billion is including the sort of ongoing maintenance of a network like that, but who's going to be paying for this internet access? I mean, it's all very, is it just a purely philanthropic exercise, or is this a commercial exercise?
The $1 billion investment, I suspect that's probably the initial investment rather than counting in ongoing costs. But also, it's very admirable, and this is a very real problem, and it is going to take the big tech companies of the world to solve it. So good on Google for at least giving it a whirl.
Now, there's been quite a lot of civil unrest in Thailand at the moment, and many citizens are dissatisfied with some of the draconian rules and curfews that are being imposed on them by the ruling Royal Thai Army after a military coup. Well, citizens have apparently appropriated iconography from quite an unusual source, and that is Susan Collins' book, The Hunger Games, which has obviously famously been turned into movies. The gesture is a three-fingered raised arm salute that's being used as a rallying sign of a population tired of the ruling power's oppression. Now, in the book, it was used by the hero or heroine, Katniss Everdeen, as a sort of quiet show of defiance against a cruel central government. It was also used as a sign of solidarity among communities affected by the brutal tournament, which was used to pacify them, where they kind of pitched young people against each other in the kind of battle to the death, literally. But over the last week or so, we've seen quite a few pictures emerge on social media of Thai citizens using this gesture, and some of them are tweeting it and actually specifically referencing that they have taken on this symbol from The Hunger Games, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, it seems, I always love this kind of thing where it's, rather than art mimicking politics, the politics that happens in the real world actually mimics art in some way.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in a completely kind of different situation, we saw that happening a lot with The Thick of It last year. Just, it almost seemed coincidental, but this is a kind of a different example whereby they've obviously kind of associate with what the characters are going through and have adopted this.
Yeah. Well, didn't we heard politicians actually use the term omni-shambles that
was popularised
in The Thick of It. And, you know, these kind of weird self-referential things. I guess it's the literal meaning of a meme, the way memes kind of propagate between culture. But some of the protesters have apparently applied some of the concepts of liberty, equality, I was about to say égalité in the French way, and fraternity to the three-fingered gesture, which is kind of interesting. Those apparently deeply entrenched in the democratic process of Thailand and obviously France, quite famously. This week, the symbol was actually banned. The gesture was banned by the army. A spokesperson for the army said that although they wouldn't do anything about an individual using the sign, if political gatherings of five people or more were to use it, they might take some action. And if it persists, they'd have to make an arrest. Now, this is another example of the army trying to quash creative expression and protests in general. They have banned large political gatherings. They're enforcing curfews throughout the country, blocking websites and TV shows. So
I think this is really radical. It's a really peaceful form of protest.
Yeah.
It's not as if it's a violent thing that's quite kind of causing riots and that kind of thing. And also it's really interesting that the Thai government are sort of recognizing it as such, and they're almost, I think, enforcing the parallel between themselves and the repressive regime from The Hunger Games.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But I mean, there are other gestures that have been banned in some countries. I mean, the Nazi salute in Germany is obviously is illegal there, and I remember there's always stories about people training their dogs to give it and that them being outlawed. It's not, I mean, obviously Nazi salutes aren't funny, but it's kind of this slightly ridiculous legislation around very culturally powerful gestures. It's actually amazing that these gestures even have that much power of defiance or, you know, instilling fear in other people. If you can think of any other interesting examples of where cultural memes have been reappropriated in real life, and you know, whether it's in politics, from movies, from TV shows, we'd love to hear about them. Please let us know on podcast@wired.co.uk. So a lot of people are nervous about or don't really like Google Glass, and hence why we've got the word glass holes, which people bandy around to talk about the sort of techno-utopian Silicon Valley types who go around with little regard for others wearing said smart glasses. But there's a German artist who's found quite an extreme way to deal with these glass holes.
Yes, that's right. So Berlin artist Julian Oliver has written a simple program called glasshole.sh that detects any glass device attempting to connect to a Wi-Fi network, which it kind of identifies based on the unique character string that he claims he's found within the MAC address of Google's augmented reality glasses. So if you wanted to go about creating an anti-glass device that you could use for yourself, what you'd have to do is get a mini computer like Raspberry Pi or BeagleBone and install Oliver's program onto that computer, and then plug it into to a USB network antenna, and voila, you have yourself a Google Glass detector.
Excellent.
Yes.
But so, it doesn't just detect it, does it?
No, it does not. So you can program it to just do something as simple as beep when a glass wearer is close. But you can also, once your device has spotted that glass is on its radar, it will impersonate the network and send a deauthorization code using a program called AirCrackNG, and this will actually shut glass down remotely.
Well, is it shutting? So, it kind of disconnects it from the Wi-Fi, doesn't it? So there are quite a few apps you can use, the nefarious apps that are, I think there's an Android one, the name escapes me, but where you can do this, you can, if you're on a Wi-Fi network, you can disconnect everyone else's phones or laptops from it. And this is kind of the same thing, but it's just specifically targeting glass wearers.
Oliver actually claims that this glass booting device is entirely legal. It's much kind of like the mobile phone jammers, which have been adopted in schools and libraries and even some government buildings.
Okay.
So he claims that it's similar to that. And he actually came up with the idea after a friend who was an artist was disturbed when guests showed up to his art exhibit wearing glass, and he didn't know whether they were photographing, recording, or maybe even live streaming his work over the internet. And he had no sort of, he couldn't really tell what was going on. So this is why Oliver kind of created this, because he really believes that people shouldn't be filmed when they don't want to be.
And that is one of the biggest fears that people have around glass. And that's why people are so uneasy. I mean, I think the other day we had a quite big BBC technology journalist in the building, and he had his Google Glass on, and he popped his head round our editor's office, and our editor was naturally quite concerned that he was recording because he might be revealing the Wired trade secrets.
Yeah, of which there are, of course, many.
There are, yes, very, very many. He might, you know, bust the robot that's controlling us all.
Yeah.
But again, you can think about people like cinemas obviously hate people recording in them. Yeah. And if you can do it more discreetly, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, and I think there's been at least one sort of major bust up in a cinema in the US where I don't know if the person was recording or not, but they ended up with lots of law enforcement people surrounding them. And just because, I mean, it could just be caused by confusion, you know, people seeing these devices and not knowing what they're being used for. They could be switched off or whatever, but it's not such a big deal at the moment, especially in the UK, but increasingly this is going to be something that we're all probably going to have to think about a little bit more.
Yeah, and they're hopefully not going to look like Google Glass. They're going to be even more discreet.
Yeah.
So it'll be even less easy to know when someone's recording or not.
Yeah.
Now, the final piece of news we're going to discuss this week is about Van Gogh's ear. Now, legend has it that Vincent Van Gogh cut his own ear off and gave it to a prostitute, although a more recent study suggested that his friend Gauguin actually cut it off with a sword, and Vincent just said he did it himself to protect him. But whichever story you believe, the ear is now back.
Wow.
Sort of. a bioartist called Demet Straeber has recreated the ear using living cells taken from a relative of the Dutch painter, and the ear is currently on show in a bioreactor in a German art gallery. Now, she's actually been working on this project for a number of years. I spoke to her earlier today, and she had the idea, but obviously needed to find the genetic material to make the ear with. You know, we've got a lot of regenerative medicine techniques that you can use to generate stem cells, but she wanted it to have some authenticity. And she initially was looking to find original Van Gogh DNA, and she was looking at lots of different samples, lots of different artifacts that might have had it. So I think at one point she examined a hair follicle, or a hair that someone had had, which was supposedly belonged to the artist. Then she tracked down an envelope in a French museum and was trying to get some genetic material from the back of the stamp, which Van Gogh would have licked. And she managed to extract some mitochondrial DNA from the back of the stamp, but she found that she needed a better sample to actually grow cells. So the next best thing was to track down a relative of Vincent Van Gogh.
So how did she go about that? Because I didn't even know that Van Gogh had any relatives, but even if he did, surely by now the kind of DNA would be too diluted or whatever. But
I think this is a kind of conceptual piece. So she tracked down the great great grandson of Vincent Van Gogh's brother Theo, who's called Louvre Van Gogh. I don't know if I pronounced that name right.
I think that's right.
L-I-E-U-W-E. And he's actually also an artist. So when Demut approached him, he was really intrigued by the project, and apparently it wasn't hard at all to persuade him to donate a tissue sample. But the tissue sample, they had to actually get a plastic surgeon to come in and take it. Well, maybe he went to the plastic surgeon, actually, I'd imagine, and take a sample of tissue from behind his ear where there are lots of stem cells. And then these cells were extracted and seeded onto a scaffold, but not just any scaffold.
Oh, really?
They had to get one that exactly matched Vincent Van Gogh's ear, and apparently there's only one picture in existence of Van Gogh's right ear. So Demut found the picture and worked with a 3D artist to develop a model of the ear as accurate as possible, which was then 3D printed, and then that was then turned into a mold that was used to inject the scaffold material, which is a kind of polymer that degrades. And it was that scaffold that was then seeded with the cells, and then over a year the cells grew to create the ear and the scaffold dissolved. And so what we're left with now is a fleshy, living ear that is supposedly 1/16th of the genome of Vincent Van Gogh.
Wow, that's amazing. So this might be a silly question, but how do they kind of keep the ear alive and not, you know, so that it doesn't sort of wither up or whatever in the museum?
Well, it's in this bioreactor, so it's kind of contained in this gel, this nutrient-rich gel that gives oxygen and sugars and stuff to keep the ear alive, and it's filtered very carefully, and it was obviously a very sterile environment in the first place. The artist thinks it could stay alive for a long time, provided it doesn't become contaminated with bacteria. But it's in there, it's on for a couple of months at the Center for Art and Media in Karlsruhe. And the kind of weird addition to on top of the bio art is a kind of interactive element. So you can actually, there's a microphone that you can go and speak into so the ear can hear people. And in a very bizarre twist, Noam Chomsky, a big thinker, I guess he's a philosopher and political theorist, who's been in correspondence with the artist, was the first to speak to the ear at the opening. Which it's just so weird.
Yeah, that is really obscure. You know, the one thing that it really makes me wonder is if you could glue that ear back onto Van Gogh, how weird, or perhaps not weird, perhaps it would be dead on, but how I would love to know exactly how it would look if you now attached that ear to him. Obviously, he's gone.
Yeah, to someone. It looks very odd. It's sort of white and almost a bit translucent. Ooh. But there's been a number of projects like this. I mean, we know about Stellark, the guy who's got the ear scaffold under his arm, and he was inspired, like this artist actually was inspired by the Vacanti mouse, which had the ear on the back of it. And actually this artist collaborated with Charles Vacanti, the guy who who made that mouse in the first place in the mid-90s. And then also we wrote a couple of years ago, I think it was 2012, about a project where a student from the RCA had made genetically engineered mice with DNA taken from the hair of Elvis Presley. So there seems to be quite a lot of interest in resurrecting these luminaries using bits of their genetic material.
It's going to be a trend. There'll soon be a whole exhibition dedicated to different body parts of famous dead celebrities being recreated.
And I wholeheartedly look forward to it.
As do I.
What do you think of this bizarre meshing of science and art? Please tell us on podcast@wired.co.uk. That's all the news for this week, but still to come, we're going to be discussing all the news from Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference, and we'll be talking about whether the digital world and technology around us is making us more boring and distracted.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat, and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. And now the first segment for this week's podcast is going to be the good old Technosaurus. Now, it's been pretty hard to miss coverage of Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference. It's been pretty much wall-to-wall coverage, at least in the tech press. But in case you missed it, we've got a quick rundown of the main announcements. But we're really kind of going to talk about the subtext of the announcements, and we'll come to the real story in just a bit. But first, the key things that Apple launched were, it launched a new desktop operating system, OS X Yosemite. I was about to say Yosemite, which is such a UK fail. I actually had to even write, we pronounce it Yosemite in the article. But this, of course, follows on from Mavericks, which was the first departure from the feline naming convention that Apple was using before. Now, there are a few things to say about OS X Yosemite. It's much more closely integrated with the mobile operating system. Some of the apps have been tweaked, and the design is flatter and more translucent, and the translucence was something that Apple execs seemed to get very excited about.
That was like a major thing for them, that and the typography.
But we were quite excited about the fact that you can pick up your text messages and your phone calls on your Mac, which wasn't possible before, but you can read the details on our website. Just look for OS X Yosemite, that is Yosemite, or just search for WWDC. The second major piece of news was the announcement of iOS 8, which is the latest version of Apple's mobile operating system. Now, this has a better notification center, so you can do lots of things from the lock screen, like reply to text messages or Facebook updates. Much better group messaging, very much like WhatsApp. Enterprise features, which provide better security and device management for companies who want to use Apple phones instead of whatever other phones. There's a new HealthKit app. Apple really wants to be the center of all of your health tracking needs, and it's something that we've been hearing about for quite a while, and it's very much a reality now. And the Photos app has also been tied into iCloud, so it has some very cool version control and editing tools, and it means you can access all of your images regardless of which device you took them on and from. So if you're on your iPad, you can access, well, A, all of your images in iCloud, and B, all the images you took on another device, whether it was your iPad or your Mac, if you did that, which hasn't been possible before.
Yeah, there are some nice, it's nothing major there, I don't think, but some nice little updates that will make it more pleasant to use, I think.
Yes. The final major piece of news was a new programming language, Swift, which makes it faster and easier to build apps for Apple devices. Now, supposedly it's much better than the existing language of choice, Objective-C, and it is compatible with Objective-C, but it's a very much kind of more visual approach to programming. It's going to really lower the barrier to entry to develop Apple apps, if of course you want to be locked into the whole Apple platform, which a lot of people do. So that's kind of all the main announcements. We've got much, much longer stories on our website, but many of you will have already read them or others like it, but do search for WWDC. But we wanted to quickly discuss what you really need to know from the keynote presentations. Now, the first is that Apple was really, really snarky about Android. Yeah. I mean, we've kind of grown to expect this, but it was really kind of playground level this year round. Tim Cook described Android as a hell stew of security problems. Hell stew. I mean, that is a great word.
It is, yeah.
I think he was actually quoting a ZDNet journalist when he said that, but he put it up on a big slide.
He took great pleasure in saying it, for sure.
Yeah, and he also went on about how 9 out of 10 Apple customers were using the latest version of iOS, but only 9% of Android customers were using KitKat, and saying that that creates loads of problems.
Yeah, he even created graphs and things.
There was loads of graphs. And it was kind of almost more about Android than it was Apple at points.
Yeah, and there were a few digs at Windows as well. So
so no one was spared. And it seemed a bit on the back foot when you see things like that. Like Apple, I know they have quite a long history of making little digs, but it seemed a bit overkill in my opinion. Mm. But the second thing was that despite slating Android, it was also copying loads of features from Android and other companies. So iCloud Drive, which was we've known about iCloud for a while, but it's changed it to look a lot more like Dropbox and behave more like Dropbox and Google Drive,
and also sound more like Google Drive, so,
and sound like them.
Yeah.
The group messaging, as I mentioned before, looks a lot like WhatsApp, and then deletes images and video files in the same way that Snapchat does. So that it kind of announced it with huge aplomb as if it was this groundbreaking thing for the mobile world, but it obviously isn't for most people. Keyboard QuickType is their much heralded context-driven predictive text tool. Android's been doing this for a number of years, and there are quite a few keyboard apps you can use to help you type faster.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the features that people were a bit like, finally, you've kind of caught up with Android, especially. Yeah.
What is interesting, I think, about theirs is that it's context aware. So if you're talking to your boss, it provides boss-like language. And if you're talking to your mates, it'll provide more informal language. And it stores it all locally on the phone, so you don't have to share it with any great gods of technology you might not want to share it with. And then Mail lets you keep one email open while you search your inbox, which, I mean, it's almost embarrassing. They've spent quite a lot of time talking about that, but Gmail's done that for years. It is a really nifty little feature, but it's kind of a bit of a, okay, great.
Yeah, I'm hoping that maybe they've actually improved their mail search feature as well, because it's terrible.
Yeah.
Unacceptably so, I think.
it really, really is. What else did we learn? Apple execs should not attempt comedy.
No.
Gosh, it was excruciating. Craig Federighi did a lot of presenting, and he's the guy who has amazing hair. He looks a lot like, is it John Kerry? He looks like almost exactly.
He's got like that all American sort of like silver kind of stands up slightly.
Buffon.
He
just had a terrible, terrible run of jokes. I mean, the audience, there were 6,000 developers in the audience, as they kept on going on about, reacted really positively to these like worse than dad jokes.
Yeah.
The first kind of pitfall was when they were talking about what they were going to name the latest version of OS X last year. I remember they, you know, went on about the fact that they couldn't find any more cats to name it after. But this year they joked that they were going to call it OS X Oxnard, which is a place in California, as I understand it. That was met with uproarious laughter. Then he said, oh, maybe it would be OSX Rancho Cucamonga, which is a kind of moderately amusing name. And then he said OSX Weed, because it's like a drug reference and the name of a town, guys. and he said that, you know, like that was very popular amongst some of the developers. Ha 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 ha. That was one of the comedic highlights. Another one was when he'd received an email with a picture where someone had said that Johnny Ive and Craig were working really well together, and they'd created a hybrid image of Johnny Ive, who's notoriously got a skinhead, with Craig Federighi's flowing locks on top of his head. And it was kind of done as if he just casually opened up an email by mistake, but in such a theatrical way that it was all comedy, kind of had gone to die from stage.
Also, it pains me that Johnny Ive might in any way be associated with that, because I get the impression that he's quite like cool, like he knows how to kind of stay out of this nonsense.
But I think the absolute nadir of comedy came when Greg Joswick was demoing the group messaging. That's the kind of WhatsApp style thing. First of all, he took a selfie on stage, which it's officially jumped the shark. Let's stop and talked about selfies. And then someone replied saying, oh, you've made a duck face selfie, which was, you know, also a meme of how many years ago?
Yeah.
But that wasn't the worst. The worst was when he received a video message, and it was this terrible skit involving Craig's hair again. And they'd sort of made his hair look absolutely wild, and someone was trying to tame it in the background. And it was just...
Yeah. I mean, they were attempting to sort of lighten things up, because in previous years, it's been very sort of poker-faced.
Yeah, that's true. Tim Cook did a really boring one a couple of years back, didn't he?
But, you know, I think there are better ways to be charismatic when you're doing a presentation like that. Stick to what you're good at, guys.
Yeah, and I think it's being a bit earnest and positive and less snarky.
Yeah.
But we'd be interested to hear what you think. Maybe you thought the jokes were hilarious. Do tell us on podcast@wired.co.uk. I just wanted to pick out what I thought was a really cool thing about the announcements. And I think that was some of the really nifty interactions between devices. So they've got this thing called continuity. And the idea is that you can kind of seamlessly leap from your Mac to your iPad to your iPhone. And they've done it in a really, really good way, I think. So there are a few things that you can do. It's kind of like all of the devices will now be aware of each other. So if all the devices are signed up to the same account, they will automatically be aware of each other if they're on the same Wi-Fi network or if they're near each other in the room. So they will be instantly kind of tethered to each other, essentially, without you having to enter any sort of authentication process, any passwords. You'll just get a little pop-up and you can instantly connect all your devices. And this means that you can do kind of a number of nifty things. First is being able to do phone calls from your desktop computer, which will kind of draw up on the mobile, but you'll be able to make calls via the desktop. And that's kind of cool. And the same goes for just tethering to use the data. If you want to get your laptop to use the data of your phone, again, you don't have to do any password shenanigans. But they also have a tool that allows you to instantly pick up work, whether you're on a presentation or a document, which you might be working on your computer, and to instantly pick it up on your iPad to present from, for example. And I think that's kind of nice. It's just little things that are often a bit of a faff to make happen seamlessly. They've seemed to have made happen quite seamlessly.
Yeah, it makes me really want a MacBook Air actually now. For people that perhaps were sort of straying from the Apple ecosystem or, you know, sort of maybe starting to dabble in Android a little bit. Yeah. If they've got one Apple device now, it's this that really pulls it all together and makes it worth, if you've got one Apple product, investing in another. So this is going to be the next sort of big challenge for Android and Windows Phone and how to replicate that in a way that's going to make consumers happy, I think.
But I'm sure at this point in time we've got loads of Android fans shouting at the podcast saying that we're just shills and we're promoting Apple. We're not, but we'd really love to hear your feedback, your criticism, your positive comments. Just do tell us on podcast@wired.co.uk, and hopefully we'll be able to read it out in one of our coming episodes in the feedback loop. Now, the second segment we're going to be discussing is one that we haven't used for a while, and it's the Wired Crystal Ball. Katie, we're always talking about technology and how it makes us more efficient, more productive. We're often talking about businesses in terms of how well they're doing from a revenue perspective, how well they're doing from an output perspective. But we don't tend to stop to talk about how people deal with all of this and how do people make sense of it all and also have more fun with their lives, soft metrics, I guess it's called. And we're beginning to see a slight move towards more of an appreciation of these soft metrics. And we've got a couple of post this week, one that you wrote about mindfulness, and another one we had a guest post about promoting mischief, which we thought we'd use as an opportunity to talk about values other than kind of hard numbers, sales, and efficiency.
Yeah, so first we were sort of thinking about social media, and we had a great guest post by Eamon Carey looking at how we don't really have enough fun on social media and how it's kind of full of pictures of hot dog legs and perfect status updates, and how we kind of we take it all a bit seriously, and there's lots of sort of vanity and posing and not so much sort of mischievousness and poking fun at each other. It's a really good point, because it does stop things like Facebook, I think, from being the kind of the fun places that they could potentially be. And Kerry says that the digital world is sort of full of the sublime and ridiculous, the insufferably po-faced, the trollish, or the unimaginably useful and beneficial. But he thinks that we need more kind of a Monty Python of the mobile world, or a South Park of the social world. So he actually kind of went about trying to tackle this by when Farmville, that app that you either love or hate,
out of my mind.
Yes. When it was at his height, he actually went about creating a sort of satirical take on it.
He, Farm Villain.
He created something called Farm Villain. Now, this allowed you to sort of give your friends herd mad cow disease, or salt the earth on their farms and burn their barns, and all sorts of these kind of things. And it was one of these real sort of viral success stories where it started out kind of making waves, and within weeks there were hundreds of thousands of daily active users, and within months it had reached millions, and they even received a warning about getting sued by Chuck Norris. And finally they licensed the app and IP to a massive American games company. And what he puts the success of this down to is that he was doing something different that was not what people expected.
It's kind of interesting. I think his point is also about businesses having mischief as part of your business model. So there are very, very few businesses that have a really good sense of humour.
Yeah.
They're so worried about offending people that they, you know, just completely bland. And I think that is something that he's trying to capture here. Because he does say that, you know, on the internet, there is loads of mischief.
Yeah.
On like 4chan and Reddit. And there is a lot of kind of piss-taking and fun. But you just don't see it very often integrated into apps or businesses.
Carey thinks that as a society, we could all do with more of these moments. And while life isn't a laugh a minute, we need to have more things that lift us up and elevate us and engage us, make us think, make us pause, which leads nicely to the second article that we had this week, which is about mindfulness, which is another phenomenon in the digital world that's offering us a way to kind of lift ourselves out of the daily grind and make sure that we sort of pause and take a little bit of time out from technology, but also using technology. So technology's been blamed a lot for having people sort of always on and being a real distraction and this kind of thing. And ironically now, it's ended up in this sort of adoption of meditation and mindfulness that probably wouldn't have been able to happen if it wasn't for the sort of apps and the technology that have come out over the last few years. One really great example of this is Headspace, which is probably the most popular, well-known app for mindfulness.
And just for people who might not be aware of what mindfulness is, this is kind of like, it's meditation, but without any of the sort of religious or spiritual mumbo jumbo that's often associated with it. A lot of people are put off by meditation because of those associations.
Yeah. And I was actually talking to Andy, who is the voice and the face of Headspace this week, a little bit about this as well.
So what sort of exercises can you do through the app?
So it basically, it sort of teaches you to calm yourself down, just take a little bit of time out and to distance yourself from all the thoughts that are running through your mind all of the day and give yourself a bit of a break from that. And there are great health benefits associated with it as well. And it's been found to increase the sort of plasticity of your brain, your ability to kind of take on problems and solve problems, and also for mental health problems as well. It's not just the people that you might think that have really taken this up. It's been a lot of people who you would never usually think that would A, either admit to meditation, and B, never admit that it was actually doing anything for their general well-being. But Arianna Huffington said the other day something like, 2013 was the year that everyone came out of the meditation closet.
Yeah. Well, I completely agree. There are a number of tools that you can use to sort of help you handle the deluge of information. I mean, I'm sure we can have a kind of inbox competition with our listeners, but we must get probably like maybe 400 emails a day into our inboxes. And so at some point, sometimes you have to stop trying to treat it as something to keep on top of, but start treating it as something just like flowing past you. And occasionally you dip your toes in it and occasionally you don't. But I've done some really kind of weird things recently, like I've started listening to white noise instead of music at my desk, and it'll either be celestial white noise or it'll be white noise from the kind of TV static thing. And I find that really helps me focus. But then there are other tools where you have a browser extension that will only let you view certain websites at certain times, so you can have like a 2-hour ban on social media, or you know, only accessing websites that are going to improve productivity.
Yeah.
And I think that this is, as you said, it's ways that technology is actually trying to help minimize the amount of information overload that we experience.
Mischief and mindfulness, I think, should be a theme this week.
Yeah, and do tell us. We do want to hear what tools you're using. And yes, as Katie said, what mischief you're making, podcast at wider.co.uk. And that is a perfect opportunity for us to move into the feedback loop. Now, the first piece of feedback we have this week is from Mark Catherall. And he wrote in about our discussion on lab meat. And this was kind of locally grown lab meat made from live animals. So you take a live animal sample and then you could grow meat from it without having to kill it. And he said, I thought that it would pose an interesting problem for various groups who currently don't eat some or all meats. I'm thinking of Jewish and Islamic laws defining how an animal must be killed in order for it to be kosher or halal, respectively. In the case of lab meat, no animal was killed at all. This might be a relief for vegetarians if their logic is based on not wanting to kill animals. So he's asking whether Jews and Muslims would eat this kind of meat. I think this question is way out of my depth, but I'd be very interested to hear from people who are conforming to kosher or halal food rules. Is it rules? I'd be very interested to hear what your thoughts are on the matter.
We've also had an email this week from somebody who has spotted our story about Google's latest self-driving car. So Jamie Hewitt Hunt says, I listen to a lot of podcasts that have spoken about this car, and I've just listened to your podcast, and yet none of them have mentioned the fact that if you're on a bus or in a taxi, you have no control then either. So the debate shouldn't be about whether you are in control or not. It should be about whether we trust a computer more than a professional driver.
I think the concern was about whether or not you would need to have an override system for the automatic car, for the driverless car. And yeah, as you say, you don't have an override system for a dodgy bus driver, do you?
No. And you don't have seatbelts on a bus either. Not, well, most of them. So.
But I think you kind of have this trust, well, faith in the fact that they have taken some sort of training and are probably only moving at about 5 miles an hour most of the time anyway. So perhaps that's where it comes from. The final piece of feedback is a very quick one. We were talking, was it last week or the week before that, about the giant dinosaur discovered in Argentina that's believed to be the biggest ever discovered. It was supposedly weighed 70 tons when it was alive. Now, Ollie Kaunt suggested a name for it because they hadn't quite named it yet. And he said, Pfeffin Bigosaurus.
I like it.
I like it too. I think we just need to inform the relevant dinosaur authorities.
Yeah.
And it will be a shoo-in. That's all we have time for this week. So I want to thank you all for listening, and we will be in your ears next week. Bye.
Bye-bye.